Blog Talk Radio.
Turnbuckle Turmoil fans, QT and Sun Guy with you here on another Sunday afternoon. Really quickly before we jump into things, if you're looking for wrestling today up in our neck of the woods, NWA Blue Collar Wrestling, where I will be later this evening in Portland, Oregon. PNPW happening in Astoria, Oregon today. SPW in Valparaiso, Indiana. California Championship Wrestling from Hollywood in Port Huneme, California, KDW in Jeffersonville, Indiana, and Primetime Wrestling in Georgetown, Kentucky today. Today we are talking about cruiserweights in professional wrestling. Cruiserweight division, something that has been around for a number of years. It is very exciting, a very different style than we get from the heavyweight division on a normal basis. And joining us, one of the premier cruiserweights in the North American continent today, the Gift, Jason Kincaid. Mr. Kincaid, to start, you want to tell us what classifies you as a cruiserweight and what led to you being a cruiserweight in professional wrestling?
First of all, greetings, grappling fans. Thanks for having me on here. And, I think more than just, like, a weight class, the cruiserweight definition of a wrestler is really a style. Sometimes it's referred to junior heavyweight, especially with the influence of the Super J Cup in Japan. But really, I think it's about, like, that mixing of the different styles, because the cruiserweights had to travel around a lot in the early days. So you got a mixing of the European style of mat wrestling with the lucha libre high flying and the hard-hitting Japanese wrestling, along with the American style. And I think, to me, that's what cruiserweight wrestling really is. It's like the boiling pot of professional wrestling, where it all comes together.
On the cruiserweight really became in fashion in the early to mid-90s. WCW developed a cruiserweight division around the mid-90s. And like you said, the styles really started to change and develop from what we had seen previously from junior heavyweight divisions and light heavyweight divisions. There was a more of an emphasis on high flying and fast paced matches, as opposed to what we'd seen from the smaller wrestlers in years past. What do you think led to the change in styles going from a junior heavyweight and light heavyweight division and involving into the cruiserweight division that we're more familiar with from the mid-90s forward?
I actually think it goes all the way back to the 70s and those Mark Rocco versus Marty Jones matches in World of Sport in Great Britain. Those guys were wrestling at a much faster pace than anybody had seen before. It influenced guys like Dynamite Kid and the original Tiger Mask, who went on to further that style even more, which influenced guys like Chris Benoit, Chris Jericho, who are the ones that brought that cruiserweight style, I believe, to mainstream America in WCW. I really just think it really stems from all those guys having to work harder because of their size to get where they're at. So when you're a smaller guy in the land of giants, you really have to have something special about you to get to that level. So I believe that out of necessity, those guys trained all around the world. They wrestled everywhere, and they had to do whatever it took to be the best in-ring wrestlers that you could possibly be. And I think that's really what drives the cruiserweight division, is the lack of size has to be made up for with effort and skill.
Do you think that the fans of today in 2016 appreciate the cruiserweight style more or less or about the same as fans that were watching the cruiserweight divisions, say, 15 to 20 years ago?
That's an interesting question, because I'm not sure that the fans appreciate it anymore, because even if you go back to the WCW days when, like you were saying, that style really first came into mainstream prominence, Rey Mysterio Jr. was a big-time merchandise seller. So even though he wasn't on the top of the card, he was still a major draw. So I think the fans have always been responsive to it, but I think it's just come into recent years that the higher-ups, the marketers in professional wrestling, the string pullers, have started to respect it as being accepted by the fans. I think the fans were ready for it before people understood that the fans were ready for it, if that makes any sense. But definitely now, during this time, with guys like Bryan Danielson being on top, in the top of all the sport, and wrestling a style that, you know, could have easily been from that WCW 1996 cruiserweight division, I think it's a really cool time. And I think, yeah, that cruiserweight style has finally risen to the top of the sport and been accepted by not only the fans, but also the people who pull the strings in professional wrestling.
Being a cruiserweight on the independent circuit like you are, do you find that promoters are more accepting of the cruiserweights and what they can do in the last few years, since we have seen a lot of cruiserweights in the mainstream promotions advance to the heavyweight championship and wrestle out of the division with some success? Or do you see promoters still trying to classify the cruiserweights as cruiserweights and keep them separate from what the heavyweight division does?
Yeah, I would say the latter is more true. I think that the people who have came up with that mindset, like, in their development in the sport, kind of hold fast to those ideals. So I don't really think that mainstream wrestling accepting the cruiserweight style in a main event or a heavyweight championship role has really affected independent wrestling that much, because there's just a lot of people that are very stubborn and stuck in their old ways and that aren't ready to make that move forward. But there's plenty of independent promotions that were doing it before it was accepted into mainstream wrestling that continue to push that envelope of allowing smaller guys with a much more fast-paced, high-flying, action-packed style to be featured in prominent roles. So I don't think it's really affected it too much in independent wrestling.
We've seen several instances where women's wrestling has had promotions exclusively to that division. There's been some very successful ones, some less successful ones, but there's been a number of those promotions. Do you think that if the right promoter came along, a promotion exclusive to the cruiserweights would be successful in today's market?
I think it's already happened. I think that's what Ring of Honor was to begin with. If you look at all the guys that helped build Ring of Honor, it was a very cruiserweight, prominent promotion. So you had guys like the American Dragon, Low Ki, Christopher Daniels, the list goes on, Amazing Red. All these guys were top guys in Ring of Honor when it in its inception, and it continues to this day. I mean, if you look at the top guys in Ring of Honor now, there are some awesome heavyweights in Ring of Honor, but it's really driven by cruiserweights and the cruiserweight style, in my opinion. So I definitely
Ring
think
of Honor.
Work elsewhere, but I feel like Ring of Honor has already built that bridge.
Oh, Ring of Honor did feature, like you said, a number of cruiserweights, but I don't know if they ever specifically marketed a cruiserweight division. Do you think they would have been perhaps a little more successful if they would have went all the way with it and promoted it as a cruiserweight promotion at the time?
No, I don't think so. I don't think that's necessarily a smart marketing strategy. I think just featuring wrestlers of all sizes within that style in prominent roles, I think, is more advantageous than limiting yourself to a specific genre. If you look at Japanese wrestling, the Super Junior tournaments drew really big houses. They sold out many arenas. But the junior heavyweight-based promotions weren't necessarily the biggest ones because I think they boxed themselves into too specific of a genre. And I think Ring of Honor is smart not to box themselves into that genre and really just feature the cruiserweights in that style in prominent roles without outright coming out and telling the fans that this is what we're giving you, if that makes any sense.
It does. Now, for the cruiserweights that are out there today, you come across a number of them in your career. Do you think that, by and large, the cruiserweights are trying to separate themselves by wrestling in a cruiserweight division against guys that are more similar in their style and size, or do you think that the majority of the cruiserweights active today are eyeing being in the heavyweight division and wrestling the top of the heavyweight guys in most of the promotions where they wrestle?
I think it's a mix. I think a lot of guys really like that style so much that they want to stay in the cruiserweight division so they can continue to really push the envelope, because I feel like the cruiserweight division is where the envelope gets pushed the most. Although in recent years, man, some of the top heavyweights have been pushing the envelope. Like, if you look at guys like War Machine and Ring of Honor, those guys are really pushing the envelope of what heavyweights do as far as the powerlifting maneuvers mixed in with the high-flying maneuvers, and really incorporating some of that cruiserweight style within the heavyweight division. So that makes guys like me, who are kind of on the verge or like on the line between cruiserweight and heavyweight, because I mean, I'm 6 foot tall. I'm right around 200 pounds. I can bulk up to 210, 220, no problem. Or I can drop weight down to 170. So for me personally, I would like to continue to push the boundaries within the heavyweight division at some point and kind of graduate to that top level, because still within this industry, the heavyweights are seen as the main event guys. So I really just think it's a mix. Some people want to stick within their lane, and then others like me want to just continue to move forward. So sometimes that means getting out of your lane and getting into the passing lane.
You mentioned being able to bulk up and cut weight. Being a cruiserweight, do you train differently going into matches against other cruiserweights, or if you know you're going to have a string of matches that are mostly in the cruiserweight division, as opposed to if you're going to be wrestling guys that are bigger than you in the heavyweight division?
Not really. My training doesn't really differ very much because, like I said, I'm on that line between heavyweight and cruiserweight. So I feel like no matter what I do, I kind of have a slight advantage because my style's so different. And being on that line, I'm stronger than a lot of cruiserweights naturally, and I'm faster than a lot of heavyweights naturally. So I just let my style do its work, and I train 110% regardless of what my upcoming matches are, and just do me.
A lot of the younger cruiserweights coming up that want to wrestle more or less exclusively as a cruiserweight, what advice would you give to them as far as training and diet so they're in the best ring shape that they can be while still maintaining eligibility as a cruiserweight?
As far as training goes, cruiserweight division requires a lot of endurance. So I would recommend when you're weightlifting in the gym, doing a lot of supersets and moving from one exercise to another rapidly and just keeping your heart rate up. A lot of wrestlers, young wrestlers especially, because they don't get a lot of ring time, they try to make up for it on the cardio machines, running on the treadmill or on the elliptical or whatever, but I don't really feel that that's applicable to professional wrestling. I think all you're doing is training yourself to be able to run long distances. So I feel like more body weight exercises and lifting heavy weights at a rapid pace while switching back and forth between different weighted exercises is much more applicable. And also, as far as diet goes, the cruiserweight division is a very tough division on your body because of the spectacular moves and hard-hitting action that we put forth. So I think high protein, high fiber, very low grain diet. Like, personally, I go gluten-free. And the reason being is the gluten protein can lead to inflammation, and inflammation can really lead to some major problems in guys' backs and knees who already have injuries and already have inflammation. So just any type of healthy lifestyle is applicable to wrestling. But I would definitely recommend low grain. And once again, as far as exercises go, just stay off of the exercise bike and start doing some squats, kids.
At this point, my co-host QT is standing by with some questions about cruiserweights, so I'm going to hand things to QT.
Well, thank you, Sign Guy. Hello, Mr. Kincaid.
Hello.
Mr. Kincaid, Sign Guy, rightfully so, jumped right into the questioning, but we forgot, or Sign Guy may have overlooked in his excitement, our standard question: how did you get started in this crazy business?
Well, I always wanted to be a professional wrestler, but I didn't really ever see it as like a thing that people actually did. So it was always a pipe dream that I never thought anything would come of. But then I read Mick Foley's book, Have a Nice Day, and I read about his training and how he got into the business, and it really made me think that I could do it. So I looked into like a bunch of different training schools online and there was nothing close by. I was still in high school. I was 17 years old, but I was really dedicated to wanting to find some place to learn my craft. And I just happened to be driving through my hometown and saw a sign at the Holiday Inn that said Pro Wrestling Tuesday Night. So I went there. I asked about training. I met a guy named Scotty McKeever, who was the first guy that helped bring me into the business, and went on to train with the Batten Twins, who were a very good territory wrestling tag team. And the rest is history.
Now, have you ever met Mick Foley in person at a book signing event?
Not at a book signing event, but at a couple of different wrestling events where he was doing personal appearances.
Okay. All right. Well, now, I did some research, and now the Cruiserweight is a popular weight class in America. But other than that, not so much. Back in the 1920s and 30s, you had weight classes in professional wrestling taken a little bit more seriously in the United States. However, Japanese professional wrestling and Mexican wrestling and British wrestling, to some extent, take their weight classes much more seriously. Now, I did a research of the lightweight class in Mexico, and I found out that it's between 139 and 150 pounds, or 63 kilograms and 70 kilograms. Do you yourself follow the lightweight wrestling class in Mexico?
I think I'd be more like a welterweight in Mexico, I believe. Right now, I weigh around 190 pounds, give or take, whether or not I hit the Chinese buffet today.
Oh, okay. Now, Ken, for our Turnbuckle Turmoil Records, can you name your favorite buffet in your general area?
Yes, OK Chinese Buffet in Oak Hill, West Virginia.
Oh, wow.
Shout out for a discount.
Oh, wow, okay. How much, in a typical day, how much can you gain eating at this buffet for our Turnbuckle Records?
I would say I could go at least 8 pounds heavy.
Damn! Wow, okay, that's pretty impressive. Okay, all right.
That's if I go away from my diet and start carb loading on the lo mein.
Oh, lo mein, okay. Lo mein, okay, very good. Well, Mr. Kincaid, I found out that the Mexican National Lightweight Championship was created in 1934, and that makes it one of the oldest wrestling championships still active today, the Mexican National Lightweight. Yes. And I found out that this championship has been vacated on a number of occasions, most notably 4 times, because the champion moved up a weight class, and that was 4 times. And once because the champion was not a Mexican citizen, and once because the reigning champion, Guerrero Samurai, was killed in a car accident. So that's pretty much vacated, you know. You have that kind of a lot of in American boxing vacated because the person couldn't make weight. And sometimes in Olympic freestyle wrestling where they're disqualified from making weight. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Mr. Kincaid, the match I remember most in WWE with the largest weight difference was when King Kong Bundy was in the ring with Little Beaver. Do you remember this?
Yes, I do.
No, oh, okay. What was your initial reaction when King Kong Bundy body splashed Little Beaver?
I saw that when I was an adult, so I actually thought it was pretty funny. Maybe if I would have watched it when I was a kid, it would have horrified me. But
oh, yes.
As a cynical adult, I found it quite entertaining.
Oh, okay. All right. Now, on TV, I think the greatest weight difference was when King Kong, I mean, comedic sense, on a sitcom, it was when King Kong Bundy met Bud Bundy in the ring, and Bud Bundy was dressed up as a bumblebee.
I watched that as well.
Oh, wow, okay. All right. Well, Mr. Kincaid, you mentioned that the fans are starting to appreciate the cruiserweight and the weight limit itself. In an example, you cited Rey Mysterio. Did you know that the NWA World Welterweight Championship is a professional wrestling championship governed by the NWA Alliance and currently promoted also by the NWA Mexico promotion?
No, I wasn't actually aware of that.
Well, this championship predates the creation of the National Wrestling Alliance in 1948 and was initially known simply as the World Welterweight Championship, promoted by Empresa Mexicana de Lucha Libre, or CEMIL. Yes. That's the welterweight.
Interesting.
And I saw where the current champ of this division is Imposter Jr., but I'm not sure how much update that is. Have you heard of Imposter Jr., the welterweight champ of Mexico?
I have not, but now that I know that he is the welterweight champion of Mexico, I'd just like to formally challenge him here on the podcast any day of the week. Let's do this, Imposter Jr.
Wow, all right. Well, that's a first for Turnbuckle Turmoil. Now, Mr. Kincaid, I also did some research, and I found out that El Santo was the first NWA holder, and he won this title on March 15th, 1946, in Mexico City, and he held the title for 337 days, El Santo.
That's really cool.
And the second champion was Jack O'Brien, and he captured the title in Mexico City also on February 15th, 1947, and he held the title for 804 days.
Seems like the record I could break.
Wow, 804 days, that's over 2 years. And now the third champ has a name that sounds familiar, Gory Guerrero. He captured the title on April 29th, 1949, and held the title for 805 days.
See, I feel like I can end the match with Imposter Jr. with the Gory Guerrero special and tie it all together.
Now, for our fans that aren't familiar with the Gory Guerrero special, can you describe this to our fans, Gory Guerrero special, or what? Yes.
It's actually hard to describe, but it's basically a version of a Canadian backbreaker where you have the person's legs tucked in between your thighs and you've got them bridged over your back. So to visually picture that in your head, you're going to have to know what a Canadian backbreaker is. And I would recommend Google in this day and age rather than having me describe it to you.
Wow. Now, have you yourself ever been caught in a Canadian backbreaker?
I have.
By whom? Who was your latest opponent to slap this on you?
That's hard to say.
Oh.
Usually, I'm just thinking of fighting out of moves, and I don't keep a log of who's put me in what moves. But I do recall that I don't ever want to be in a Canadian backbreaker again, especially, like I said earlier, with this cruiserweight style being so hard-hitting and having inflammation in my back.
All right. Hey, now, how many people have you made tap out when you've applied the Canadian backbreaker to them?
I'm not a power wrestler. So if I use a move like that, it's typically not to get the submission, but more to wear down my opponent to later beat them with a more high-impact move.
Okay. All right. Well, now I also did further research in this NWA World Welterweight Championship category, and in the reign of combined length, a wrestler named Carlos Legrand had three title reigns, and for a combined 4,802 days. Unbelievable. That's like Cal Ripken's consecutive playing days in baseball. I kind of equate it with that. 4,800 days. Do you kind of agree that that's kind of Cal Ripken-like?
I do.
Okay. All right, and the number two longest reigning welterweight NWA champ was Blue Demon. And he had two title reigns for a combined 2,197 days. Unbelievable. Yes.
I believe it. I'm not that incredulous.
Now, if you move down the list, at number 23 for combined length is a wrestler named Darkness Dragon. And he had one title reign for 236 days.
Shout out to Darkness Dragon, Ultimo Dragon trainee.
There you go. If I ever was a full-time wrestler, I'd like to name myself Semi-Darkness Dragon. Yes. Yes. All right. Well, and next, at number 24, I saw a wrestler named Fishman, and he held the title for 224 days. Okay, and you know, now this weight class is not only limited to wrestlers that were born in Mexico or Mexican citizens. There was a now I think this might have been a Japanese wrestler, but he was known as Kato Kung Lee, and he's at number 32, and he held the belt for 106 days. Kato Kung Lee.
Nice.
All right. Now, I also, Mr. Kincaid, did some research on the flyweight, and that is the lightest weight division known in pro wrestling, and it's pretty much limited to Mexico, and it has a 52-kilogram or 150-pound weight limit in Mexico, 115.
Yeah, that's pretty hard to come by here in the States.
Yes. Now, in boxing, speaking of the States, the limit is 112 pounds. That's flyweight. And I also, and according to the MMA rules of the Nevada State Athletic Commission, as of 2000, the flyweight division is limited to 125 pounds or 57 kilograms. Pretty interesting, 125 pounds. And if you step up to junior bantamweight, the existence of any pro wrestling titles are not confirmed, so there are no junior bantamweight titles. But there are bantamweight titles to be won in Mexico, and the weight limit for this is 57 kilograms or 126 pounds. And for MMA, according to the rules of the Nevada State Athletic Commission as of 2000, the bantamweight limit is set at 135 pounds. That's for MMA. And I also did some research on the New Wrestling Alliance, or NWA, World Junior Heavyweight Championship in Japan. And that is owned by the Japanese Pro Wrestling 01 promotion. The title is meant for wrestlers under the weight limit of 100 kilograms or 220 pounds. As of March 1st, 2015, the champ was Minoru Tanaka. Have you heard of this wrestler, Minoru Tanaka?
Yes, I have. I have.
Oh, you have? Okay. All right.
A great junior heavyweight competitor out of Japan. I'd definitely like to face off against him one of these days.
Oh, okay. Well, now, Mr. Kincaid, boxing and wrestling have often had a tenuous relationship. In the 1980s, you had the great lightweight Roberto Duran, and he fought in that weight division for quite some time. I think it was 60 title fights in that lightweight division. But then he had trouble making weight, and he moved up to the super welterweight shortly after he vacated his lightweight title. Super welterweight didn't last too long. He moved up to regular welterweight and then junior middleweight. And he was joined, of course, by Sugar Ray Leonard, Marvelous Marvin Hagler out of Massachusetts, Tommy the Hitman Hearns out of Detroit, and to some extent, Pernell Sweet Pea Whitaker. It's kind of rare that boxing had five superstars all within that cluster of a couple years vying for the title. Do you see any, wrestling cruiserweights that will achieve this golden era of five championships that captured the imagination of the United States like they did in the early 80s with Sugar Ray Leonard, Roberto Duran, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, Hearns, and Whitaker?
I was like, Mr. Kincaid has dropped the call, QT.
Oh, man. Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm going to ask that question to you, son guy. The golden age of middleweight boxing and some light middleweight boxing was captured by those boxers. I don't see really anything like that in the cruiserweight division currently with MMA or wrestling. Do you agree with this assessment?
Maybe not to the level where it's going to carry a promotion as far as being the top draw. But I think WCW had a golden age in their cruiserweight division when you had a Rey Mysterio, Dean Malenko, Ultimo Dragon, and several guys of that status all vying for their cruiserweight championship when it was new.
All right. I could see that. Okay, that's pretty good. Now, Sangai, as you know, in bodybuilding, most of the among the public, of course, are the heavyweights. You know, you've got Lou Ferrigno, you've got the Mighty Quinn, Lee Haney, and Arnold Schwarzenegger. That was quite some time ago. The most famous cruiserweight that I can think of was Franco Colombo. That was Arnold Schwarzenegger's lifting partner. Franco Colombo was probably the most famous. He really impressed Arnold Schwarzenegger because Franco could squat 500 or 600 pounds for 15 to 20 reps. Would you agree that Franco Colombo was the wrestling equivalent of the most famous cruiserweight in wrestling? That's my question.
Probably so, I would think.
Oh, okay. Now, Sign, I also, you have passed this video on to me, I think, on a number of occasions, and I myself was very aware of it. Playboy Buddy Rose, when he would sometimes enter the ring, he'd grab the microphone from the announcer, and he would say, "I weigh a sculpted 217 pounds, and of course he never came pretty much close to this weight, and he never came close to a cruiser weight. However, that's pretty much the most, I'd say, my favorite, heavily promoted 217-pound weight limit. Would you agree about wrestlers speaking in the ring about their weight size?" Yes.
Buddy Rose was probably the most famous guy that did that, but a lot of wrestlers over the years would proclaim to be cruiserweights when they were clearly heavyweights or super heavyweights. You saw a lot of times the angle would get recycled where a guy that was on the cusp of being cruiserweight or heavyweight would win the cruiserweight title and then struggle to keep the weight down, and they would do crazy things to try to make weight. That's been done a number of times by a variety of wrestlers. Chavo Guerrero Jr. did it, I believe. Christian did it when WWE had their cruiserweight title going. Sort of a tradition, it usually got a pretty good reaction as a comedy bit when a guy that was right on the edge of being a cruiserweight versus a heavyweight would try to be in the cruiserweight division and then try to maintain the weight to be eligible.
Yes, and I also got a kick out of when Buddy Rose would go to the beach and he'd do promotions for a specific shake that he was drinking, a weight loss shake. There's a couple videos out there of him posing on the beach with fairly attractive women. Yes.
He had that, and okay. He also did the blow away diet where he would pour the powder all over his body, then a fan would blow the fat away, and he would claim to be a slim, trim 217 from being on the blow-away diet. And, he, to my knowledge, was never a true cruiserweight or light heavyweight like we would think of someone that was full-time in that division, like a Mike Graham or a Ricky Morton or a Dean Malenko. He was always a heavyweight that was sort of doing things tongue-in-cheek at the cruiserweights.
All right, Sign. Can you see any Squamish Championship wrestler or blue-collar wrestler on a blow-away diet? And if so, who?
Gonna say Tyson.
Tyson Tomko, okay. How about Mother Truck and Otis? Could you see him on a blow-away diet?
I could not.
Okay. Well, Sign, now Chris Taylor, he did wrestle in the 1972 Olympics, and I believe he got the bronze medal. And I'm not sure where he wrestled in college, but Chris Taylor pretty much had a huge advantage over his opponents just by sheer weight advantage, and that also played out in the Olympics. I think that Chris Taylor's weight led to specific heavyweight and super heavyweight divisions in collegiate wrestling. I'm going to have to do a little bit of research into that, but Chris Taylor may have been the precedent to set some weight standards in collegiate wrestling, if I'm not mistaken. Yes.
He was an extremely large man.
Yes. I think he topped out at 380 pounds, didn't he, or 400?
I believe he went over 4, especially when he turned professional.
To your knowledge, Sign Guy, are there any videos of, well, when did Chris Taylor break into professional wrestling? Must have been right around 74 or 75, right?
I believe slightly earlier than that, maybe 71,
72. Wow, right after the Olympics. So,
I believe
he never wrestled. He never wrestled Bam Bam Bigelow.
No, he passed way before that. But, a lot of the cruiserweight guys that were around in that era, they would be matched up against him on television, and it was the age-old David versus Goliath story that would play out. You'd have the smaller guys trying to beat the large power guy, and a lot of times did not work, but we've seen in the last 25 or so years, a lot of times that works in wrestling. You see a lot of smaller guys upset bigger guys, the cruiserweights, especially in the 90s, started upsetting a lot of the heavyweight main event type of wrestlers. And I think that did a lot to establish the division. You had, for example, the 1-2-3 Kid, who probably topped out around 200 pounds, was known mostly as a cruiserweight, defeating Razor Ramon, who was around 290 pounds, definitely a heavyweight. On Monday Night Raw, you had Rey Mysterio Jr. beating guys like Bam Bam Bigelow, Kevin Nash, Ric Flair. So I think in the mid-90s, 93 through 97-ish. Lots of cruiserweights defeating the heavyweights, I think, did a lot for fans to really get into the cruiserweight division because they saw the cruiserweights on par with the heavyweights, and it wasn't just kind of a niche division that a minority of the fans could enjoy. You saw fans enjoying cruiserweights because they were intermixing with the heavyweights and then going back to the cruiserweight division. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I kind of agree with that assessment. And, Sign, I saw last night, you and I were both at Squamish Championship Wrestling at the Tribal Gym, and I saw three different wrestlers at different weight categories that didn't even really approach the heavyweight division. I'm talking about Kane, Dean the Drifter, and DeMarcus James. Now, DeMarcus James may come closest to the cruiserweight division if Squamish Championship Wrestling had that. I think
yeah.
DeMarcus James might
go... Did you say if
they
had it?
They
have an established cruiserweight championship that you saw defended.
Oh. Okay, well, how heavy do you think DeMarcus James go? Now, I don't think he's ever announced his weight in the ring, but I'm going to guess he goes 175 pounds.
I would guess he's a little bit north of that. I'd say DeMarcus probably around 190, 195 maybe.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe after a buffet like Mr. Kincaid, yes. Okay. But one that's clearly a step below that, maybe below that, would be Dean the Drifter. And I'm going to say he probably goes about 165. And if you equate that today with boxing, that would be right on the cusp of super middleweight to middleweight. Middleweight goes 160, and super middleweight about 168. Would you agree with this weight assessment of Dean the Drifter?
That might be a little bit light for Dean because he's right around 6 feet tall, but I just got confirmation, DeMarcus, 180.
Whoa, 180. Okay, so we're pretty close there, DeMarcus, 180. Now, how did you come to this bit of information? I'm very curious. Was this information sent to you by Devin Bellinger?
It was not. I shouldn't reveal my sources, but I have a pretty good source.
All right. Okay, very good. All right. So we got DeMarcus, and then we got Dean the Drifter. Now if you step down a little bit, and I'm going to say maybe in the junior welterweight class, if there was one, maybe welterweight, I'm going to say Kane.
Well, Kane James competing in that cruiserweight title match. So he definitely a contender for the cruiserweight championship. I believe Kane goes, I'm going to guess around 147.
Okay, 147. That would put him around a super welterweight in today's boxing and MMA class. About probably super welterweight, yes. I think you and I can both agree that Kane probably has one of the top three thinnest waists in Squamish Championship Wrestling. Yes.
That's an entirely possible, accurate statement. I believe possibly the smallest weight, the person that won the championship last night, the brand new cruiserweight champion, the first ever female cruiserweight champion at Squamish Championship Wrestling, Phantasma Ekis.
Yes, and Sign, there are rumors who this identity is underneath that mask. Can you update us on any rumors swirling around? And is she indeed not from the West Coast? A lot of scuttlebutt out there, especially from Dimitri. That's what I heard. Yes.
I haven't heard any rumors. She wears a mask all the time, so I cannot speculate. And to my knowledge, she is from the West Coast, but you can never tell, I guess.
All right, what do you think the difference is between her weight and Kane James? I'm going to guess probably around 15 pounds, 15 to 20 pounds, 20 pounds. Seeing that Phantasmal is 20 pounds his junior?
That might be accurate. I would never ask for her weight, of course, but that seems like a reasonable guess. Now, of course, at NWA Blue Collar Wrestling, the two of them recently had a match.
Oh, can you tell our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners who may not have witnessed that match what the outcome was?
Kane won by pinfall, if my memory serves. That was a very good cruiserweight-style match.
And how long did the match last?
They wrestled probably for 15 minutes.
Okay, 15 minutes. Very good workout. Now, Sign, a lot of our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners want to know if you took the ferry last night. That's one question. Yes.
I did not.
Now, Sign Guy, there's a lot of pressure that's going to be put on me for our top Turnbuckle Turmoil 9 and 7-8 Northwest Wrestler rankings that I hope to get out on Tuesday. Now, a part of these rankings will be based upon what you witnessed tonight at Blue Collar Wrestling. Will you be able to give us flash results? That's what I'm asking. Yes.
I believe I can make that happen.
Now, in your opinion, will there be an uproar if Phantasmal is rated lower than number 5? Will there be an uproar? Because yeah, she's kind of set a precedence, sort of.
She really did. She is the first female cruiserweight champion in the history of Suquamish Championship Wrestling.
I'd like to tell our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners that I was almost physically accosted and someone demanded that Phantasmal be ranked higher than number 5, and I'm not going to disclose who this person was, but I myself slightly trembled at his or her insistence. Yes.
Well, it could be the cruiserweight's time to shine this week.
Well, that's true. Okay, all right. I myself will not seek legal advice in this almost intimidating demand that was put on me, and I will bear this pressure. Yes, I'm hoping this person listens and I can see your passion. Yes, and I will try to accommodate you. Yes. Yes, a sign also, Coach Mike Jones might figure in the mix. He had a very nice wrestling match last night. Your thoughts on the coach with the most? Yes.
He was in a tag team gauntlet, and there were decidedly no cruiserweights at all in that match. None at all. All heavyweights in the tag team elimination match.
Boy, I hear that. And, Sign Guy, I think I'm going to look back and finally remember this SCW event last night because I finally got to introduce myself to Dale Pierce. And Dale Pierce said it was nice to place a voice with a face. I'm very glad that I got to shake this legend's hand. Yes.
Absolutely. Well, QT, we got just a few minutes left, so I guess we'll wrap things up. I will be down in Oregon for NWA Blue Collar later this evening. Check us out there. Get out there, support your local independents wherever they may be. Support the cruiserweights. They are very hardworking athletes, very exciting. So if you hear of some great cruiserweight action, go give it a look. Support what they do. And we'll be back with you next week. Next Friday, we have Bob Cook with us. Next Sunday, the return after a very long absence on our show of Dylan Bostick, so it should be a great week next week. We'll talk to you then.
Once a man is left.